Yeah, welcome everyone watching online. I'm pleased to welcome Danny Ushizima, who's a staff scientist in the Computational Research Division at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, where she has worked for the last 10 years. We got to know her through collaboration and an event we did at the Berkeley Institute of Data Science at UC Berkeley, where she's also a data science fellow. She's here to talk to us today about her work on general purpose investigation across image domains. And her talk is going to be about searching images with images, characterization, retrieval, and ranking. With that, Danny.
Awesome. Thanks. Thank you, Vani, for the kind introduction. Good afternoon. It's great that we have an audience here and kind of small. We're going to get the chance to interact a lot, so interrupt me at any time. First, I would like to thank Vani for agreeing to be a keynote speaker in our presentation, in our event this week, Image Across Domains. That's going to happen at UW. This is organized by Kevin Coy, Stefan van der Wal, Ariel Roken, and there's a third person, and myself. Part of this new initiative to look into pictures across domains. So, who am I? I'm Danny Ushizima. I work at Berkeley Lab, which is very generous to also let me to hold an appointment down on campus as a data scientist. So, hold a bunch of hats and very excited today to be here at Microsoft. First time I'm at a Microsoft facility and. I remember the first computer I've ever touched, and of course, it was running MS-DOS, you know, old days, and mouse was not even a thing at that point. So I've been looking forward to be in a Microsoft facility. What's for today? So today we're going to see work performed at Berkeley Lab, and that's the picture that I'm showing at the top of the slide. And I hope to hear back from you some of the Microsoft capabilities that eventually can apply to some of the data science problems that I'm going to share with you in a few minutes. And I think the first question is, who has ever been to LBL, Berkeley Lab? Who knows what Berkeley Lab is? Awesome. Well, then perhaps it can be an interesting journey to know a little bit about the Berkeley Lab, and then I'll go into what I do inside Berkeley Lab and some potential collaborations that may come out of the science that we do in there. So Berkeley Lab was founded in 1938 by Ernest Orlando Lawrence, and that gives the name to the Lawrence of Berkeley National Laboratory. Everything started with his invention of a circular particle accelerator that kind of opened up the doors to high-energy physics. The new incarnation, if you will, of the particle acceleration is that pink building that you see in there. It's one of the imaging facilities within the laboratory. So Berkeley Lab is one of the 17 national laboratories here in the U.S. It's the only one maintained by University of California and the one that conducts non-classified Bayes and Applied Scientific Research. Our mission statement, solutions to urgent energy challenges. Now, I have a question. How many people do you think works in Berkeley Lab? A bunch of us. So it employs about more than 4,000 people among scientists, engineers, postdocs, students of all sorts. And I mentioned national user facilities, and that would be helpful to tell you a little bit about these user facilities because my work is at the interface with these guys. I'm in the computational research division, and I interface with folks at the Advanced Light Source. That's the first one where they have the particle accelerator. ESnet is the way the information goes about. That's the networking folks. JGI is the Joint Genome Institute. The Molecular Foundry is the place where several experts and chemists will cook up the, you know, the new recipes of films and with all sort of applications, for example, deploying the next generation of electronics. And NERSC, which is the supercomputing facility. And with that, people across the world, about almost 10,000 people have access to these facilities. So if you're an archaeologist and eventually you want to have imaging of your sample, you may apply for a time at the beamline or at the beamline inside the advanced light source to have access to the structure of your samples. It's a center of excellence, and that's one of the fun things about LBL. You get to meet fantastic people ranging from Nobel Prizes, folks from the National Academy of Sciences, engineer, and so on. So we have a bunch of representatives inside the laboratory. And with them also some Nobel laureates, and we are very proud to brag about the director of BIDS, the Berkeley Institute for Data Science, Sol Perlmutter, who besides having a Nobel Prize in Physics also is a great advocate to data science. So I'll start talking a little bit about my research within the laboratory and my search for energy, extraordinary powers, and amazing gadgets. Within the laboratory, I put 10 there because it's going to be 10 years that I've been working in Berkeley Lab this coming August. So everything for me started in my quest for energy. Since I was very little, energy was something that fascinated me, particularly when my mom said, oh, go turn off the lights. And I really didn't want to. As somebody afraid of the dark, having access and control of energy was a big thing until I was able to get the switch, right? Another interesting capability that I really enjoyed as a kid was being able to see. And I think probably that's why light and electrical energy were so important to me. I want to see. Vision was kind of a superpower. And speaking of superpower, one of the people that really inspired me to work with government data was Linda Carter as Wonder Woman. And what about her specifically? She was this person with extraordinary powers and amazing gadgets, responsible to take care, protect information, and fight crime, and eventually, you know, aliens. So while I've been trying to spin around and try to turn into my hero and not being able to do so, I've been able to play with government data, and that has been incredible. Great adventure. So let me tell you about this adventure across the scales. So the x-axis, these are spatial scales, y-axis, time in which these phenomena are occurring. And I'll start telling you about who's the villain in each of these scientific problems? What's the superpower, which is the instrument capable of acquiring information about that phenomenon, and how do we use it? So the first one, this is a nanoparticle. I think the villain here would be the ability of two portions of these particular nanoparticle to be tightly coupled. That's platinum and palladium. The challenge is how you put them apart. What we're seeing is the visualization when most of the problem is solved. How we do the segmentation of these data? The data here is STM, which is a type of electron microscopy. Another problem here is ocular fundus. This is a picture of the back of the eye. The challenge is to find where are the vessels. The reason to look for the vessels is you can quantify stage of retinopathy if you have access how these the vessels are distributed, the branching of the vessels, and so on. What's curious is the algorithm used for the segmentation in the first example of the nanoparticle, with a few tweaks, can be also used for detecting vessels. It's a front propagation-based algorithm. That algorithm again, now with a head CT. And the goal here is to strip the skull of that brain, of that human brain. And that's what the red line, you may notice there is a red line associated to that picture, and that's the result of segmentation. How we work it out to have front propagation to work in a scenarios in which there are places where the front may bleed. We call that bleed because it will go out of the zone of interest. Through a lot of interactions with the domain scientists, we're able to identify things that they call foramen and probably I would call the holes on the skull, and try to map those anatomical portions from individual to individual in order to come up with algorithms that solve in a more accurate way. Another example here, sort of on a kilometer scale already, is how we can detect targets. This is a synthetic aperture radar image in which you have boats floating in the ocean and you need to detect those little objects on the ocean surface. So these are some of the applications kind of superficially. Let's drill in a few of them. And I picked a few of energy-related applications, some of them with support of a few people and also collaboration with others, a bunch of folks in industry as well. And I'm putting Microsoft there, so I remind myself to say thank you for the allocation. We're still looking into how to best use Microsoft Azure to solve some of these problems. And if you have any ideas how we could be tapping into the resources that you have, we would love to learn. Energy research applications. One of the things that that we depend upon is the particle accelerator. That's what I'm showing here is a picture of how is it inside of the particle accelerator. And each of these lines is what we call a beam line. So there is sort of a microscope, fancy microscope, at the end of each of those lines. In this particular one, which is the beamline A32, we have equipment that allows you to see inside the objects. It's X-ray vision, pretty much like Superman, where we have Dula Parkinson, our collaborator, physicist working at the beamline, capturing a bunch of pictures. Well, at the end of the day, he wants more than picture. He wants to aggregate value to the data that is collected at the facility. To do that, he needs to detect different phases of the material and other information. So I'm going to illustrate a few kinds of samples that we can image using the advanced light source. This is one of the examples. What it is, it's a glass bead, and the experiment has to do with our Earth scientist, in this case, Jonathan Aberfranklin, wants to check how to do injection of supercritical carbon in the subsurface. Let's get rid of the CO2. We're going to put, under the rug in the subsurface. Well, in order to do that, we need to make experiments how we're going to seal it up so that the CO2 doesn't go back to the atmosphere. Before we actually deploy that into the environment, there are experiments in the laboratory how that could possibly happen. So what this genius in the earth science domain figured out was that if you mix a microbe called spores or Sina posteri, it loves CO2 and start precipitating. So we basically would do all the plumbing throughout the CO2. You pump CO2, it will do the cement of that particular well that you inject in CO2. Okay, enough of the science. What do we do? The input are pictures as the one on the top left for you. Lots of artifacts. What you want at the end is something like this one in blue, but not only the visualization, also metrics associated to the permeability and porosity of that material. Is that bug really doing all the cement that it's supposed to do? So that's a little bit of the eye candy associated to this project. Those are where the data sets that we collect, lots of artifacts that are kind of inherent of the image acquisition process. So this is microtomography. We'll have the same problems that tomography does have, like ringing artifacts associated to the transformation of the light integrals to the cross sections. Another project, also with that same instrument, the Beamline A32, is to study ceramic matrix composites. There are lots of applications. A main one is the construct of jet turbines. This project particularly counts with a collaboration on Rich Bale, Robert Ricci, folks within NASA and US Force are also interested in the material. My interest is to help them to quantify how tough is this material. In order to do that, we need to separate the different faces of the material. Remember, there's the orange. Here we identify already where is the bulk of the 3D volume. Then we need to identify each of the fibers that are reinforcing this material to later detect where the fiber pullouts, and that's in green that you're seeing there. Welcome. A little more about this resistant composite. The goal here is to identify fracture patterns in the microtomography imaging. What have we done to produce those visualization? The visualization per se is using or ParaView or Visit. These are two visualization tools, but in order to show each of the phases of those material, we need to do a bunch of processing. One of them, sort of the first steps, is to filter these data sets. They range to between 60 to 100 gigabytes a pop, and they also want to track these fractures over time. So you can imagine how hard it is, how time-consuming it is to do all the filtering so that you can remove artifacts, experience variations on the intensity in order to get each of the fibers. This is the initial step before we go about detecting each of the fibers. Each of these circles is one fiber. And this is the portion with the ceramic matrix composite. So what did we do? We constructed this plugin that works within Fiji. That was a way to get starting this communication with the users, the domain scientists, dealing with the micro-CT. In order to scale some of these algorithms to near real time, we need to parallelize a bunch of these algorithms using a combination of OpenCL and Java. Java is just the interface. Everything else on the computation is using OpenCL. So we can deliver 3D nonlinear edge-preserving filters as well as a bunch of morphological filters and allow streaming processing while streaming. And of course, that couldn't be possible without two folks working in my team, Hari Krishna and Talita Persiano. They have been key people working in this project. That's a little bit of the configurations of the machine that we tested this paper. Perhaps we can do something similar on Azure. I would love to learn how to do that kind of image processing inside Azure. A little more about the structure modeling. Well, that's only filtering. It doesn't just make the picture look a little better, improve contrast, but how do you get the fibers, for example? So we're using an algorithm called template matching, and here I'm putting the two main steps. First, you detect which of the prototypes are best associated to the place in your picture. So let's think about the picture as F. And then you have a prototype that's going to be sliding throughout your picture until you find exactly one that looks like as if you were looking for faces in a crowd. We have a few faces of potential people. These are the prototypes here. And with those faces, we want to look into the picture where we find a closer match. And after we do that, we calculate a normalized cross-correlation to basically check similarity as well. First, similarity between the prototypes, and then similarity between that particular prototype and the picture itself.
The top function there has a fuzzy matching ability built into it, so it finds close the top formula there.
You could have more than one prototype that's closer. We're just going to get the closest. Up to the point that we can get the fibers in here. We can calculate the fiber pullouts. These materials are under tension as well as temperature variation. So they are checking when is it going to break. Before we deploy an airplane ever, we want to check how these fractures are going to happen. Are these fractures associated to the fiber pullouts? So these are some of the analysis that we need to bring at hand. And wouldn't it be great if we were able to do that near real time? Because most of the times what happens is the user comes to the advanced light source, spend 2 or 3 days there, including night shifts, and they go back home with the raw data. Maybe the case there was dust on the CCD and all the experiments is in vain. So it would be great to have this real-time feedback and fix problems as they are acquiring the data. Okay, I promised the visual search, but where is this visual search coming at hand? Well, for me, it came throughout these 10 years, a lot of data curation, having our own mechanical Turks telling us what are the patterns that you're looking for, how well these algorithms are doing. So gathering a ton of data up to the point that we're able to do some modeling, acquire signatures of each of these faces, if you will, the faces of scientific data that we're dealing with, up to the point that we can make some predictions and can do classification, where this sample has a fracture, this one doesn't have, or this cell is malignant, this one is normal. So that's a little bit of the story, how we're growing towards the visual search and being able to deal with data corruption, gigantic files, and a bunch of other stuff. So this kind of shifting from the application and going to what happened after, you know, this 10 years, actually 8 years, the Department of Energy thought that this idea of working with image across domains and working closer to the data facilities could be a good thing. So they decided to give funding to for me to pay particular attention to this problem. So that's the mission of this DOE ASCAR, which stands for Advanced Scientific Computer Research, Early Career Research Proposal, to really aggregate data value to the data collected at DOE facilities, either at Advanced Light Source or the Molecular Foundry. So the user comes to Berkeley Lab and goes back home with more than just the raw data. Help these scientists to discover relevant but hidden information inside those pictures. And the focus is very broad. It's across domains. In order to do that, we need definitely use a bunch of machine learning algorithms, and I've mentioned a few. So machine template matching is one of them. We're using, neural networks. And I'm going to show a few more examples in here. The goal is to accelerate analytics, reducing the time between the experiments and hopefully giving feedback pretty quickly while the user is still on site. Why visual search? One of the reasons was sort of egocentric in the sense of that because I work with several different domains, one of the questions that I have at least once a day is, where is the picture? Why can't I just query my computer or my storage just showing a picture? I want you to retrieve the picture of brain. That's particularly simple. I may not be able to describe perhaps with words, but I can show a picture, or I can even draw. Thinks that here at Microsoft, I think you're very advanced, particularly with the Surface. I had the chance to see somebody playing with the Surface in which they were drawing and being able to recover pictures that are similar to that sketch. So why now? Actually, this has been going on quite a while. We have, you know, if we look into the past 10 years, there are lots of developments that brought us to the state where we are in terms of using pictures to recover other pictures. A very common example is this one that I'm putting here as a movie in which we're able to show pieces of the picture and retrieve other pictures by similarity. So recommendation systems is a great example of how visual search can be empowering. Well, thing is, the scientists, my colleague scientists are less interested in lamps and shoes than how to find their data sets, how to retrieve pictures using their pictures. And most of us, what are we doing? We're binging. we're Googling, we're using general purpose engines to find pictures. The problem is we need to navigate through half a zettabyte of data when we're looking for pictures using, you know, just keywords. This is very inefficient. We're definitely drowning in the amount of data that we have. We would like to do that in, you know, very specific database so we get to compare apples to apples. So with that, finally, we have a great perspectives for 2026. So in a little less than 10 years, what we have right now is a prototype. That's what we got at Berkeley Lab, thanks to two professors that worked with me for 2 years, Flavio Araujo and Romero Silva. We put together this Python-based tool called PyCyber, which stands for Content-Based Image Retrieval, that allows, through a very simple interface, use the power of GPUs in order to classify pictures using pictures. So let me show a little bit. That's the interface, how it works. Incredibly simple, just tapping into the file system and being able, and that's the output of that particular tool. So giving query pictures of a very abstract pattern. Here, that probably only folks working at the beamline would be able to recognize as similar. The tool can bring pictures that are very similar and even classify for these samples in the database are previously classified. So this is an example using diffraction patterns. This is micro CT tomography, X-ray based imaging. This is light microscopy, and something happened. Okay. No problem. So I was telling you about PyCyber. What's the stage? It's still closed. It's not public available yet. We do plan to make it available. There you go. And I believe we're about here. So one of the things that we really like about that project is that we can leverage a lot of information previously curated. And the cell is an example in which we have pathologists working with us for the past 3 years and checking, well, this cell is normal, this is abnormal, the cervical cell has this particular problem, this one doesn't. So now that we have, you know, quite a large data set with a few thousand samples, we're able to look into unseen cases and perhaps providing cervical cancer screening using more automated methods. So far, most of the countries except US, UK, and a few other really rely on conventional Pap smear for doing cervical screening, and that's all manual. And you would say, well, why people don't worry about it? I ask that question myself, particularly given the fact that this is the most deadly cancer on East Africa. It's the seventh most deadly type of cancer within women population in Brazil as well, India, and a few other countries. A little more about that example on the cells, how everything started in this interest into cervical cells. It started and got us to the point that we can do some of these pre-screening using PyCyber, at least within our own laboratories. It's not that we're gonna, people tend to come to me and say, oh, are you gonna solve the problem of cervical cancer? You're gonna cure cancer? That's not quite it. What we're doing is to provide a tool so that the pathologists can do their work faster. As part of this mission, one of the things that we worked on was in detection of these cells. In order to train some of these classifiers, like the one in PyCyber that uses convolutional neural networks, we need samples, classified samples. It relies on supervised classification. So we've been training algorithms at least to detect where is the cell. Can you even tell where is the nucleus and cytoplasm of the cells? And that's what we've done for quite a while. And currently we count with BIDS support, Science Without Borders, and Gordon and Bette Moore Foundation support to move forward with that. One of the fun things that happened throughout this journey was that together with my team, we're able to get into a competition. We're super scared at first because we were sort of new. About 5 years ago, we were sort of new in this business. And we got first place in a code competition. So there's hope. Perhaps we can do something. And we actually invited Bill and Melinda Foundation to take a look at the project. It was not the right time, but we'll continue pushing that forward as one of the things that we would like to do with Microsoft.
Do you have a
yes.
partnership with doctors in medical networks?
Oh, yeah.
So they're constantly providing you feedback.
Yeah, so one of the things that I actually didn't bring, but I'm happy to talk to you, is a database that we construct. We call it CRIC. In which the pathologists can, either using their cell phones or their laptops, tablets, whatever, quickly go through pictures, new pictures, and classify using a very user-friendly interface that we design. Using just the web, they are not willing to install anything. You know, the pathologists, or they don't have the resources, or they don't have the time or the expertise in that particular area to, deal with common line, for example. So through the browser, they would just check and classify the cells for us.
Can they classify sub-areas of the cells? Like, so if they said this cell's bad, and then outline and kind of guide it to where, what to look for?
That's a great question, and we went through this process. So we have two ways in doing this classification. One of them is in which you basically tap into the region of interest and tells this program that, oh, there is a cell, and by the way, this is abnormal. Not exactly with details about where is the cytoplasm and the nucleus. There's another mold in which we do have that. So morphometry, to test algorithms, particularly in morphometry, that metadata associated to each of the samples in the database, we have that information. But for most of the database, we have only the normal and abnormal. Did I answer your question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you.
So moving into some of the things that I try to do with cells, certainly, I got to learn how to use Microsoft tools to improve the problem in cervical cells. One of the things that I try is what happens if I just throw into the Bing images that particular cell, what's going to return? And at this point, it returned that as a necklace. So probably I'm using the wrong tool, or I would need actually to deploy that to a very specific data set. So very curious how I can do this job much better.
Kind of like a Rorschach. You show them pictures, and first thing that comes on their mind, you can.
Well, that's exactly what got back. You know, I went there. There was an option to upload your picture, and it came back as a necklace. Not that I wouldn't wear a necklace with that kind of pendant, but I was expecting at least like, oh, it's a cell or a clump or of some sorts, but it didn't come that way. But again, the spirit of telling a little more of what's going on inside Berkeley Lab and what we've been doing, I went through this particular project to show you a few visualizations. This is a summary of what we're doing, and what I find most relevant is what I'm putting in red characters here, which is provide software that works to multiple problems such as ceramic, cement, textile, samples that I acquired as a micro CT. This was one of the first tools that we put in the public domain. You can download to check it out. I think part of the time that we spent deploying this tool was actually have a conversation with the Microsoft operating system. But that was incredibly important because most of the users, guess what, they depend on Microsoft OS. So it's important for us to make those tools compatible to Microsoft tools. Anyway, another thing that we've been working on and we're very excited about is to interact with the Molecular Foundry. That was one of the first projects that we have had with them, particularly involving Intel. The goal is to cook up a particular recipe for building films, very thin films. In order to do that, they need to analyze the quality of these films. What we did is to design features that characterize the coalescence of pores, basically when pores are gluing to each other or they are organized. So for those that are familiar with some of the feature descriptors, you can use energy and entropy to characterize the roughness of surfaces. So that was one of the things that we did and deployed to this particular project so that they could differentiate different types of films and different qualities. Oh, there's much more, and I can do the whole laundry list here. One of them is a working collaboration with folks within the mathematics group within Berkeley Lab and a few other groups, and with the support of IBM, which let us play with their neuromorphic chip. We've been deploying CNN-based algorithms to run in the chip. We tested with a few examples. One of them is molecular structures as well as the micro-CT. Another work that we've been doing is in collaboration with the UCSF, University of California, San Francisco. That's the medical school. The question, what they have is whole brain. So people that died and donated their brains for Alzheimer's disease studies. What we do is to basically slice the whole brain and then have, well, before slicing, we have the MRI, and then we have the full slice of that brain and look for particular structures that might be associated to Alzheimer's disease. One of them is the locus coeruleus. That work caught with the help of Leah Greenberg, who's a doctor there, and a common researcher working with us, Mariana Lager. Well, in conclusion, and with plenty of time for questions, I believe. So what's the superpower here is vision. Definitely there are so many problems that can be solved with computer vision. It's not a silver bullet. It doesn't solve all the problems. But as the experiments within the laboratory more and more are reliant on acquiring a digital picture, I do see a lot of potential in having more computer vision capabilities available to the domain scientists. And definitely we need to automate. We're producing far too much data. You know, they're upgrading the facilities, and then I have the impression that the processing, the analysis is not going at the same speed. So villains here is, you know, these data files have data corruption, they are gigantic. We're looking for multi-phase objects. Sometimes these objects are occluding each other, so several challenges associated to those particular data set. We cannot have the postdocs just doing, you know, delineation of objects. We need to move on and automate part of this process. And I think the hero here would like to point out the collaboration. Through these collaborations with folks in different areas, we've been able to deploy visual search. At least we have a first prototype, and we really hope that that will support science advancement throughout the laboratory, if not even beyond. And with that, I would like to acknowledge the faces behind data science within Berkeley Lab. The camera, the Center for Advanced Mathematics for Energy Research Applications here on top. These are the folks. This is the director, James Sethian. The deputy is Jeff Donatelli. This is the Data Analytics and Visualization Group. This is the leader, Wes Batho. I was used to be the vice deputy, time to pass the torch, and now Gunther Weber is the new deputy of the group. And the Berkeley Institute for Data Science, so that's on campus, directed by Saul Perlmutter, and our executive director, Kevin Coy, here, and a bunch of other folks within UC Berkeley dealing with the data in it. It's several facets. And just a finalize with a disclaimer. If whatever I present here works for you, then thanks to LBL and UC Berkeley. If it fails, it's all my fault. You know, blame on me. Thank you.
Questions?
So the retinopathy problem that you talked about, can you talk a little bit more about what you're doing there and how different it is from the niche processing that you're doing on the cervical cancer problem? Is there anything common between the two?
There are things in common. One of them is the segmentation problem itself. On the vasculature, the algorithm that I'm using in there is called fast marching. It's a partial differential equation based algorithm in which you plant seeds and you allow fronts to move outwards and will not cross the boundary based on the intensity variations. You can use other characteristics as you're moving the front and basically checking, you know, how dark it is. I don't want them to be too dark, or even control how this front behaves. I want to keep a certain level of curvature. You know, don't allow, you know, too much of a convexity or concavities and so on. So that's the algorithm behind the vasculature. Could we use that for the cells? We could. We're not. What we use is a combination of a graph-based algorithm to detect the blobs where the clumps of cells are happening. Very easy to detect where the nucleus is. We do that by intensity itself. It's the staining protocol. And by chatting with the pathologist, we learned that, you know, the nucleus will always be very dark, so you can use that information. And with biology of probably second grade, it's like, okay, cytoplasm is always around the nucleus. That's where we should look for the cytoplasmic area. So then what we do, we use the nucleus as the center of a Voronoi cells, basically calculating the distance between what are the points that are closest to this nucleus as opposed to this one, and exactly where they are about the same, you put a line, and that's basically the principle of calculating the Voronoi diagrams. You use that to make the first chop of where it's more likely to have a cytoplasm associated to that particular cell. And that was probably what made us get the first place, that was the bad, you know, in a mathematical way, in giving the parameters that were measuring the accuracy of the algorithm, that was the best strategy. We've been working and improving because, as you notice, the Voronoi diagram is just going to chop with the straight lines, and by no means cervical cells are like that. So what we do then is to get that idea of the front, but instead of going from the nucleus and, you know, slowly propagating from there, we can actually make it propagate much closer to the answer. So instead of exploring a huge domain and iterating, you just iterate within a narrow band. So that's one of the things that the same algorithm, completely different applications, can really succeed. Yes.
Are any of these algorithms that you mentioned integrated within statistical libraries that they typically use in medical imaging processing, like statistical parametric mapping, what we call SPM, that's the library for, it has many algorithms for segmentation and processing of MRI, fMRI. Have you integrated your algorithms into those, or?
It has been a little bit of the other way around, and that particular problem that I showed, the brains, particularly Mariana Allegra has been doing is to tap into ANT's algorithms, mostly for doing all the registration. A lot of the problem there is associated to registration and most of the computation as well. Because what's happening is when, you know, the MRI, it's the full thing. When you go chopping, you know, there's shear and tear, a lot of deformations, and putting that back is what costs the most. So in order to do that, she needs to do, you know, diffeomorphic transformations of the data to put that together.
So when you spoke about image search using images, and you mentioned the work from the two researchers that collaborated with you, cervix cell, cancer cells, right?
Yeah.
You mentioned CNN, and so, and you also mentioned that you've been producing data for training your model. So basically, I understand that what you have underneath is it's some supervised approach for matching those images, right? I'm actually surprised that on the context of searching images, you're not using unsupervised approaches. Have you tried something? Why it failed if you did? Why you choose to? Well, I can see that supervised approaches will give you certain classes that you're more interested on. But so what is the rationale there to not try unsupervised approaches in this problem area?
Okay. Let me break. Yeah.
Many questions in one.
No worries. I'm trying to break in pieces. So the first one, why supervised? At first, we want to be able at least to answer, did you detect this pattern or not? Is there a fiber there or not? Is there a fracture there or not? And then we're sort of trying to grow on that. So there is a kind of fracture, and that's the type of fracture. With the cells, the same. We start normal and abnormal, but we know that this is not enough. There is abnormal precancerous. There is abnormal, you know, high stage. So that's how we're growing. We want to be able to get the class of that so that we can enable pre-screening. Mm-hmm. Going to the unsupervised, can we do that? Of course. The way the software is working right now, if you have no classification whatsoever, what you can do is to use things like Inception and basically turn all your pictures into compact signatures going through a CNN. So basically you translate your big picture into a feature vector of sorts using CNN, or perhaps you don't even need CNN. The problem is just so simple that you can use LBP, you can use HOG or other feature image-based feature descriptors. Have a bunch of signatures associated to your database, and then there comes, you know, a new picture, and you want to see, well, I don't know exactly the classification of these guys, but I'm able to give something that's similar to it. I have no idea if it's a horse or an apple, but they are similar. So that will be the unsupervised mode of the algorithm.
You can see now, so I understand better that the statement of the problem is that you're searching for characteristics within the images, not the images themselves. So otherwise you could just do similar stuff and search for similarities, and that would be problem solved. Does that make sense?
I'm not sure.
So you're looking for that fracture. You're looking for those features, those characteristics inside of the image.
Yeah.
And trying to match those things, those objects.
Exactly.
To match the images themselves.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we're trying to create a sort of a Facebook of scientific pictures. And of course, it's going to return faces as far as you're dealing with a database of faces. When you start putting, you know, oranges with a little face, weird things may start happening. What I'm trying to explain by that is if we're then just a microtomography, then there it's more likely that what the system is returning as similar will make some sense, as opposed to, you know, let's put cells together with a micro CT with, you know, diffraction patterns of a grazing incidence X-ray scattering. Then things will start being a little cluttered, and we did that test. So what we did with Mariana was to get a data set to recognize fish, and he uses some neuron cells, and one of them is kind of a goatish. So returning it was a goatfish. Of course, giving those descriptors in the context, that was the most similar in that particular database, not that he had any neurons in there or the neuron was a fish of some sort. So yeah.
Every one of these pictures, the different types,
yeah,
could potentially have a different algorithm to be able to work with it. And so do you have like a growing library of all these little teeny algorithms that, like, it's like it would say, oh, that's a cement block, you know, so if you had a hole, or are you building something that's very specific to each application so that your system wouldn't be able, you do a search and you have ceramics and you have cement and metal, you know, different kinds of materials, and you know, polymers or you know, plastics. And I mean, but is that where you're heading with that?
Thank you. I love your question. And if you're asking that, it's because I didn't make that clear in the presentation. So there are two ends. One end of that is, yeah, we have a ton of data, but no curated data. So yeah, there is a large library at this point of algorithms that are really tailored to specific problems up to the point that you have curated data.
And there's the algorithms, uh-huh. Are they sometimes just models opposed to being hard-coded algorithms?
The models come more towards the other side. Well, we have this curated data sets. For example,
the one part is just the data engineering to get the data to a state that you can actually build a model on it. Right.
Oh, okay. Kind of the pre-processing.
Yeah. What I told at the beginning was actually sort of chronological in the way that things were building within the laboratory, and particularly within my team. We were helping to curate the data. We knew that we couldn't be doing manually drawing, so we designed algorithms to do part of that curation. So we got to the point that you have a ton of data to leverage. What do we do with that? Then we can use some of those discoveries to empower more generic algorithms, such as PySiber. It's those results that I showed, the data sets were separately, but the engine is absolutely the same. The cells, with the rocks, with the fabrics, we did with pills, we did the same exactly algorithm with a bunch of different applications. And that's the power of CNN, right? You're calculating all these convolutions throughout the picture, translating to a signature, and guess what? That allows you to get things that are similar.
I got one more question.
Yeah.
You guys might have already talked about it, but when you two were talking about the images, it made me think of like a kernel. Like if you're doing, you know, corner detection or something, you know, that each kernel, one might recognize different types of lines, you know, corners and stuff. That, and have you done anything like that? I mean, so that you get all these algorithms and the higher level ones that would recognize, you know, it just would be blind to everything else. It would either fire a one or a zero to say, you see what I'm saying? So you got all these algorithms, can you load them on the fly and change context? You know, oh, we were looking at a plastic, you know, Delrin block or something, but now we're looking at, you know, and I don't know if you do video or if you flip in slides, you know, the part might have plastic and metal and, you know, deformation, cracked it or something like that. Select your algorithms. You know what I'm saying? So that you look at this and say, okay, so this has got a crack in it, and then go and say, you know, let's look around.
I have the impression that when you say, can you select, is there an automated mechanism to do the selection? Is it the question?
So in your system, that you can be looking at plastic, right? And then, so you have all these different algorithms. Maybe the algorithm for looking at the plastic is slightly different than looking for deformations in the metal housing or something like that, you know, some kind of a sub-assembly. Because we were talking about similar problems, you know, some of my colleagues. You know,
okay.
How do you change? It's almost like changing gears, you know, you got this problem, now it's changed. And the problems are similar. I don't know.
In the spirit of a recycling algorithms, we do that all the time. In fact, that algorithm that we used for cells that got first place was actually started into a completely different domain, which we were looking at geological samples and try to count the number of pebbles in that particular sample. But then that was in 3D. Like, oh, all right, so the 2D problem is even easier, right? We were just looking at the cross-section and find the different connected components associated to that. Like, okay, we can use the same algorithm, and that's how we quickly transplant to a totally a different problem. So
pebbles to cells.
We do. Was that process without human beings? It was completely dependent on human beings. Looking at the patterns and identify that you could use the same algorithm. Could that be automated? And that's what you're alluding to, I guess.
And it could select its own algorithm. It could say, oh, wait, this isn't, looking at it, saying it's not a cell, and then some other algorithm, like in a neural net's running in a, you know, what's that, a GPU or something, one of them says, one of them fired, and it says, oh, that must be pebbles or, you know.
Right. Using those algorithms in which you're doing the segmentation and find each of the components, each of the phases of the objects, perhaps there is a way to automate it as an oracle suggest what would be the best strategy. What convolutional neural networks brought is the automation of that. So instead of tailoring for specific areas, some of those algorithms you could eventually train a neural network, if you have labeled a data set, to say, well, borders are relevant. So you're going automatically have phases within your data flow that will include border detection. Because at the end of the day, border is relevant, particularly for fracture. It's at the difference of the borders that you get, well, there was a fracture right here. So CNN are very helpful for those. Absolutely. But then you depend on data curation. While some of these data sets are very large, we have, I would say, few giving the universe of like data sets like COCO and you know, large data sets on the order of millions of samples. We don't have millions of samples of a curated micro CT yet. Perhaps we'll get there.
An example of the PI CIBR software that you showed. Those were those images sequences, individual images, or slices of 3D images. When you presented, when you showed the sample and the retrieved results.
We had the three different. I'm so glad with these questions because I tend to forget to explain this. So the one on the top that looked like a rainbow. Those are single pictures. One picture tells everything about the crystal lattice or the crystal structure of a particular compound. The one at the bottom with the cells, those are crops of the cells. Remember I mentioned the pathologists are clicking and say, there is a cell here, and by the way, is abnormal. So we use that particular click and crop around it. We know sort of a, you know, the footprint of a cell, so we have a window that cuts exactly that that size. On the micro CT, which was the gray level picture, that's actually a 3D sample with several cross sections, but we have the profile that's very characteristic of a particular fiber on parallel to ZX.
Is recognition there retrieval driven by two different algorithms? One tailored to 3D and another tailored to 2D images, or the same algorithm?
Because we pose the problem that way, all of them are using 2D. All of them are using the same algorithm, except that two of them are using color, the grayscale one is just using just one channel. But otherwise, it's all the same algorithm. That we're using, and you know, it seems we're very glad with the results that we're getting. But again, no silver bullet. There are problems, and perhaps you know, this is not the software to solve the problem. You have a curated data set. You've been cataloging. You have a student within your laboratory for a long time, and the student is gone. And how you can leverage that information? I mean, there is a way. More questions?
What about Azure? It sounds like you're not there yet. How
to use Azure? You mean how to use Azure?
Yeah, to put your data, your images, to collect them in there, and you know how, you know, what storage mechanism you, you know, if you've looked at any, you know, blobs or tables or that type of thing.
Yeah, I keep wondering if the same inferential engine that is used on the surface or something similar to that could work in a silo, in a specific subset, you know, detached from www or other stuff. How would that perform? And I
should, in theory, it should be fast and scale infinitely, but it could be expensive, but, you know. Is that something like Berkeley would do and then provide back a reference implementation or something? I mean, some type of thing you put your images in there and it would categorize it and, you know, partner with Microsoft and they can resell it, make a lot of money.
Okay.
So do you work with other teams? Do you work with teams within Microsoft to?
Well, the hope is to sort of start to do that. You know, this is the first visit here. And then...
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this is the first time I actually step in a Microsoft building.
Oh, okay.
Great fun.
Well, we have, we're doing similar, we have some guys working on similar stuff like that.
Okay.
I'd love to talk to them.
I would love to.
And your information's on the video, which will be posted.
Yeah.
Tomorrow. Okay.
Yeah, so I work in outreach. I can, if you can send me an email, I'd love to, you know, try and get more people together to brainstorm about how some of this can be done in Azure. I've looked at Azure Machine Learning and running that given the data set just to sort of do classification of images, but it was a really clean data set and the images are pretty small, mm-hmm. and we got very good performance out of Azure Machine Learning using an SVM-based model mm-hmm. to build a simple classifier, but we haven't really attempted, you know, throwing this data at something like CNTK or any of the other advanced sort of tools that are coming out of Azure services.
From what I heard is that CNTK is the same engine behind the Azure. It did some algorithms in there, so it's, but it just runs locally.
Yeah.
Like the TensorFlow, the Google local one.
Yeah.
Oh, so you're using TensorFlow here?
No, CNTK competes against TensorFlow.
Okay.
I don't even feel comfortable mentioning the name.
Okay, don't say the name.
Reference.
In many of the benchmarks,
okay, that's the package, one of the main engines behind PySavior. So we're absolutely leveraging TensorFlow. Happy to try other possibilities. I mean,
well, I'm glad you're here because if you use CNTK, you can get the GPU version, GPU only.
We definitely need GPUs. PySavior, I mean, so far where we get, you know, microsecond feedback out of these queries is when we're using our dev box, which is like a small cluster
with
three titans.
You can use GPUs through that allocation.
I think is it through the data science virtual machine?
No, not through that. You can just...
Because that was scary.
Yeah, you can provision a GPU-based machine through the virtual machine templates. I can show you how to do that.
Uh-huh.
And then you can try running CNTK on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess if you have a GPU, I don't know how powerful of one you need. I mean, if just your regular graphics card, you know, it can leverage it. I mean, if you're playing video games at the same time you're running your algorithm, it might be some contention. Mm-hmm. But, you
know. Okay.
So that's a CNTK. It's from Microsoft.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, Vinny gave me at least a starting point. Where on GitHub should I look for the instructions to install that?
Oh, well,
so I'm past that point. Now, I mean, anything that goes beyond, I want to try.
Yeah, instead of installing it locally, you can just install it on a GPU. In Azure itself, so
okay.
I can show you.
I absolutely want to do that. So that's mostly what we've done with the allocation that we got. We're really grateful. I'm sure we're using, you know, the tip of the iceberg of all that is possible. Basically, what we're doing is deploying tiny, you know, virtual machines so that myself and my students can be playing and be exposed to some of the cloud.
Yeah.
But mostly, they could have. Not the same because of the computational power that they don't have on their laptops, but, you know, a beefy desktop would do the same.
Yeah.
And I think there's so much more to explore within particularly the software stack that we're not, and we're eager to do so.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Bonnie.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So you guys work together?
So I work in outreach, and we provide...